But the implications are much larger, and I am being made an object lesson of what can happen if somebody dares to criticize. A person in high office, somebody in high office in this administration. So I think, Amy, this is the reason why this has sparked so much domestic outrage as well as international outrage, because, you know, people, you know, really feel, you know, that this weaponization of the law, like the cyber libel, is something that has become the modus operandi of this heads of government and officials that really do not like criticism. So, you know, the people that you talk to, you know, throughout the whole range of the society here, throughout the opposition, they have come together on this on this case, because they know that if they win this case, if the administration you know, wins this case in the judiciary, and it's likely that it will win this case because it has a very strong control over judiciary, then people really feel that democratic rights are in very grave danger. That is what it is at stake here at the moment, and I think people see it, which is why they've come together to demand that the administration, the Secretary of Justice at this point, just drop this charge against me.
Well, Walden Bello, of course, will continue to cover your case. Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar, activist, former vice presidential candidate in the Philippines, co-founded Focus on the Global South, arrested Monday and charged with cyber libel charges. He was released from police custody on Tuesday. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. Welcome back, Dana Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Stelly, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series starting Saturday, September 17th, with singer-songwriter Tim Grimm. Folk Music Series of 9 Saturday concerts starts September 17th and continues through May of 2023 at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele. Season tickets are now available. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, House Democrats pass the Inflation Reduction Act. Charter changes are on the horizon for Portland and Multnomah County. And in international news, a report finds the Arctic is warming 4 times faster than expected. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 12, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The U.S. House passes the Inflation Reduction Act this afternoon, now sending the landmark legislation to Biden's desk. It represents over a year and a half of debate and a central part of Biden's economic agenda to build back better. In the bill, there are historic investments into addressing the climate crisis and into the IRS, of all things. The bill lowers prescription drug costs, raises taxes on some billion-dollar corporations, and reduces the federal deficit. $370 billion are going to be dedicated towards reducing harmful emissions and promoting green technology. Seniors will see their drug prices capped or lowered, and many low- and middle-income Americans will be spared from an increase in their insurance premiums next year. There's fresh funding as well for the Internal Revenue Service to pursue elites who cheat on their taxes, and that, along with a new tax on stock buybacks, is expected to cover the cost of the bill. The FBI search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago home turned up 11 sets of classified information. Just this afternoon, the warrant was unsealed at the request of the Department of Justice and of Trump himself. Insider reports ahead of the announcement implied that some of the documents had nuclear significance, though it wasn't clear if it was American nuclear technology or another country's. Three criminal statutes were cited in the unsealed warrant, which is publicly available online. That includes the Espionage Act for gathering, transmitting, or loss of defense information. There were four sets of top secret documents among those taken by the FBI. Others ranged from secret to confidential. About 21 boxes were taken, as well as something referencing information on the President of France, a pardon for Trump ally Roger Stone, and binders of photos. Trump and other Republicans have condemned the search, and Trump has denied any wrongdoing. Portland and Multnomah County have changes to their respective charters on the horizon. In Portland, a three-pronged measure proposed by the Charter Commission has been challenged by different groups. On Thursday, a county judge heard those objections from the Portland Business Alliance, from an individual, James Posey, and the voting rights nonprofit Next Up. The measure was created after much consideration by the 20-member volunteer Charter Commission. It does three main things. It would divide Portland into districts, represented by 12 elected officials. It would add a city manager to oversee the day-to-day operations of the city, and it would introduce ranked choice voting in city elections. The Portland Business Alliance objected to these three reforms to the Portland city government structure on the grounds that you can't put three ideas into one ballot measure and that it would confuse voters. City Attorney Maya Higham likened the reforms to a three-legged stool. She argued, quote, "If one or two measures are approved, the one or two legs remaining makes for an ineffective stool." Higham also pointed out that the requirement that a ballot measure be limited to one idea only applies to ballot measures that start from a citizen-led campaign. It was a slate of reforms in one ballot measure that created Portland's current commissioner form of government in 1913. The other group said the name of the ballot measure wasn't descriptive enough, or that ranked choice voting was too complicated for voters to understand. The proposed reforms were part of the charter reform process, where the city appoints a commission to reassess the government structure, make recommendations, and put those up to the voters. Portland is the only major city in America to still use the commission form of government. It's been widely criticized for not being representative enough of everyone they govern, especially historically marginalized groups. Commission forms of government make it difficult to hold officials accountable because of their structure, and they're also often criticized for being inefficient. Judge Stephen Bouchon says he'll deliver a decision in the case by Monday. Multnomah County Commission voted Thursday to refer seven reforms to their ballot this November as well, though these are not packaged together, they'll be separate. Like Portland, ranked choice voting is one of the proposals for voters to consider. It would allow voters to, as the name implies, rank their choice of candidates, and if their first choice doesn't have sufficient support, their vote isn't wasted, it can be applied to their second choice and so on. If passed, the county would adopt the system by 2026. Another measure would change the charter document to having gender-neutral language. A third would require county commissioners to visit the county's prisons at least once a year, on top of the inspections already required under state law. There's another reform to add an ombudsperson to the auditor's office. That position is an advocate for the public who would help address public complaints to the county. Another would expand the right to vote in county elections to non-citizens. If voters passed this one, the county would have to figure out if that's legal, and if not, the amendment would require the county to actively advocate for the voting rights expansion at the state or federal level. As far as challenges go, Multnomah County residents have until August 22nd to try to block the measures from showing up on the November ballot. A disease outbreak, that's what Oregon's top health leaders are saying about monkeypox. State Health Officer Dr. Dean Seinlinger made that announcement and others about the disease yesterday.
As of this morning, there are 95 presumptive and confirmed cases of monkeypox in Oregon, including 92 men and 3 women, with illnesses ranging in onset from June 7th to August 5th. We see cases across 7 counties, 3 in Clackamas, 1 in Columbia, 1 in Coos, 17 in Lane, 1 in Marion, 57 in Multnomah, and 15 in Washington. About 28.4% of cases identify as Hispanic or Latino, so cases are overly represented in this group compared to the general population. Nationwide, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there are about 9,500 cases across 49 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. They are amongst 31,800 cases in 89 countries as part of this outbreak. In Oregon, our data mirror national data and show that cisgender men and non-binary people are affected by monkeypox more than cisgender women. While most identify as gay or queer and report close contact with people assigned male at birth, some cases identify as straight and or report close contact with people assigned female at birth. This means that anyone can be affected by monkeypox, and this is not a gay disease. But as I shared earlier, this is not an easy disease to catch. The most common means of person-to-person transmission is from prolonged skin-to-skin contact with a person with monkeypox, including direct contact with a rash, scabs, or body fluids. This is the type of contact that happens during sexual activity. Much less commonly, the virus can also be spread by touching objects, fabrics, and surfaces that have been used by a person with monkeypox and through contact with respiratory secretions of a person with monkeypox. These routes are much less common than skin-to-skin contact with someone who has monkeypox. However, unlike COVID-19, monkeypox doesn't spread through airborne transmission. In other words, it's not believed to linger in a space and infect other people who come into that space. So what are the symptoms to watch for? Monkeypox may start with a fever, achiness, or a sore throat, but it may also start with a rash or sores. The rash, or call 211 if you don't have one. Before the appointment, let your provider know that you think you might have monkeypox and cover any lesions you have. Ask your provider about monkeypox testing. If you have symptoms you believe to be symptoms of monkeypox, talk to your provider. Even if you're not in a high-risk category, you might deserve testing. If there is any similarity between monkeypox and COVID-19, it's that both have safe and effective vaccines. Given as early as possible after exposure and before the appearance of a rash, the monkeypox vaccine, known as JYNNEOS, can be used to prevent monkeypox infection, reduce how long symptoms last, or make them less severe. Unfortunately, as was the case in the early days of the COVID-19 vaccine distribution, the JYNNEOS vaccine is in limited supply, but the situation is improving. Oregon has distributed or is in the process of distributing more than 6,803 doses of the JYNNEOS vaccine and 23 courses of tecovirimat or TPOXX treatment since June 20th. According to our Alert Immunization Information System database, 2,187 JYNNEOS doses have been administered so far. We know that more than that have been administered, but those 2,187 doses are what's been entered into Alert thus far, which speaks to the overwhelming response partners have had to balance during this outbreak. As of today, OHA only has 35 doses left in stock, with others positioned with partners. Still, while vaccines are slowly making their way into communities that need them, supply remains limited. The first dose of vaccination starts protection, but individuals do not have all of the protection from vaccination until 2 weeks after the second dose. So it is important for people to continue taking additional precautions to protect themselves with limited supply of vaccines.
That was Oregon's health officer, Dr. Dean Seidlinger, speaking about monkeypox yesterday. Local election officials detailed in testimony yesterday how misinformation is fueling election threats. With more on that story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
No election official should have to fear for their lives while focused on their duties and service to our democracy. Our democratic process cannot survive undefended attacks on the people we rely to vote.
Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos joined House lawmakers for a roundtable about how doubts about the 2020 election results continue to impact the work of local boards of election. Former Michigan elections official Tina Barton gave emotional testimony about the death threat she received after debunking misinformation.
It was laced with obscenities, threats to my life and my family members' lives, and used sexually charged language.
The group recommended a new federal agency to counter election misinformation, aggressive prosecution of threats, and increased funding and resources for election administration. Several major news outlets are asking a federal court to unseal documents connected to the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home this week. The Justice Department also submitted its own request to unseal certain warrant materials. Attorney General Merrick Garland confirmed that he personally approved the decision to seek a search warrant.
Longstanding department rules and our ethical obligations prevent me from providing further details as to the basis of the search at this time.
The Washington Post now reports the search was regarding classified documents, including some related to nuclear weapons. Trump claims his attorneys were cooperating fully with federal investigators prior to the search. Garland also addressed a series of threats against members of the FBI and DOJ.
They protect the American people from violent crime, terrorism, and other threats to their safety while safeguarding our civil rights.
On Thursday, an armed suspect was shot and killed after an attempted breach of an FBI building in Cincinnati. His motive remains unclear. President Joe Biden signed into law a bill to assist veterans exposed to toxic substances during their military service. Millions of veterans will now be eligible for expanded health care access and disability related to burn pit smoke and other toxic exposure. The CDC is taking a new approach to COVID-19 that focuses on learning to live with the virus instead of strict infection prevention. The agency is dropping social distancing recommendations and de-emphasizes using regular testing to screen. The guidance continues to encourage testing for people with symptoms and their close contacts and recommends masks be worn indoors in about half of the country. Earlier this week, White House Chief Medical Advisor Anthony Fauci expressed disappointment over Americans' divided outlook on the disease.
When you tell people they need to mask in an indoor congregate setting when you're in a zone that has a high dynamic of infection, and that is looked upon as an encroachment on your freedom. We've never had that before. It's almost inexplicable.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. FIDRA trusts indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Voting rights advocates in Arizona say a pair of bills that just became law will make it much harder for people to register to vote and prevent thousands of Arizonans from voting. Groups are now asking a federal judge to block the measures. Mark Richardson has more.
Voting rights advocates are suing the state of Arizona over new regulations they say make it harder for some people to register and would block thousands of voters from the polls. The lawsuit targets a pair of election security bills passed this year by the Republican-controlled legislature, calling them an attempt to disenfranchise thousands of otherwise eligible voters. Courtney Hostetler, an attorney with Free Speech for People, sees them as a deliberate attempt to exclude newly naturalized citizens, communities of color, Native Americans, and others.
These laws are working to suppress the vote by basically taking lawfully registered voters off the voting rolls and making it difficult for them to either get back on or to get on in the first place.
The suit was initially filed by the Campaign Legal Center, but Free Speech for People and Arizona Tribes and other groups have signed on. GOP lawmakers claim the new restrictions will prevent widespread fraud they believe was part of the 2020 election, although there is no credible evidence to support their assertion. Hostetler believes one of the onerous elements of the bill is the inclusion of criminal penalties for even minor infractions of the election law. She says it's designed to intimidate potential voters.
think what we're seeing, unfortunately, is this concept of fraud is becoming the boogeyman that Republicans in particular are pointing to in order to wave away what I think is really at issue here, which is voter suppression.
The lawsuit alleges that the Arizona measures violate the National Voter Registration Act and the Voting Rights Bill of 1965. Hostetler says some GOP proponents have talked openly about the purpose of the bills.
One of the legislators said, and I'm paraphrasing, we have to worry about the quality of who's voting, not the quantity. And that's really alarming when you see it, who these laws target, that they do have this idea that some people deserve to vote more than others.
The suit asks that a federal judge issue injunctions to prevent House Bills 2243 and 2492 from being enforced. I'm Mark Richardson for Arizona News Connection.
Author Salman Rushdie was attacked on stage at an event in New York earlier today. The 79-year-old author was stabbed in the neck by the assailant and flown to a nearby hospital. His condition is unknown. Rushdie is well known for his work, The Satanic Verses. For some Muslims, the work was considered blasphemous because it fictionalized part of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. Since 1989, Rushdie has lived under a death threat or fatwa from the leader of Iran. In the 1990s, he spent much of his time in hiding with high security. By 1998, the Iranian president said they no longer supported Rushdie's execution, but a private religious organization maintained a $3 million bounty on his head as of 2012. The interviewer at the event also sustained a minor head wound. Officials have taken a suspect, Hadi Matar of New Jersey, into custody. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, Civic Cypher. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly sunny with highs in the low 80s. Today in history, in 1990, Sue, the most complete Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil ever discovered, was unearthed in South Dakota. The fossil is named after Sue Hendrickson, who found it. The quote of the day is from American author Edward Abbey, who said, quote, "I would give 10 years off the beginning of my life to see only once a Tyrannosaurus Rex rearing up from the elms of Central Park. We can never have enough of nature." The Arctic is warming faster than previously estimated. That's according to a new study. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
A new study finds that the Arctic is heating up 4 times faster than the rest of the world. The study was published in the Nature Communications Earth and Environment Journal. It showed that the Arctic is warming 4 times faster than the whole planet, that's double the previously understood rate. It also showed that the warming rate is up to 7 times faster in certain Arctic locations. The research team was able to identify the increased rate of warming by correctly defining the Arctic's location, with a latitude of 66.5 degrees north along the Arctic Circle. Multiple of the previous studies did not correctly identify the start of the Arctic Circle or consider the latitude of the Arctic at all. The research team also strongly considered the impact of natural changes in the circulation of the ocean and atmosphere. The rapid increase in temperature is caused by Arctic amplification, a destructive cycle where greenhouse gases cause sea ice to thin, making the sea ice more vulnerable to additional melting. Once sea ice melts, it no longer reflects the sun's rays, causing the open ocean to absorb more radiation and further melting the ice nearby. Although more research of Arctic amplification is needed, researchers believe it is crucial to be aware of the Arctic's sensitivity to global warming.
That was KBOO's Grant Button. Wildfires have the potential to release radioactive particles from nuclear sites, and global warming makes them all the more likely. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. nuclear disasters can release widespread, dangerous radioactive fallout. Research facilities and nuclear weapons tests can also leave behind varying levels of radioactive particles in soil and plants. Christine Erickson of ETH Zurich warns that at some sites, wildfires could later release those particles into the air.
Locally, in the area of the fire and where the smoke travels to, the particles will travel with that.
She says global warming and changing land use are increasing the threat of wildfires near many nuclear sites.
We're seeing more wildfires in areas that are either bordering onto or actually are contaminated areas.
That includes land near Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico and other sites around the world. She says some of these areas have a lot of vegetation ready to burn because it's dangerous to work in contaminated areas, cutting grass or trimming trees. Erickson says more research is needed to understand how much radioactive material is released during fires, how far it travels, and how best to protect those who are exposed to the smoke, so a nuclear event of the past will not endanger more people in the future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Hunters and landowners are conflicted about how to approach elk management in the West. A symposium coming up this weekend seeks to find new ideas to address the conflict, as Eric Tegedoff reports.
Hunters, landowners, and wildlife managers are gathering in Montana to discuss the need for novel approaches to elk management. The 2022 Elk Management Symposium takes place this Saturday. Kathy Hadley is a board member with Montana Wildlife Federation and participating in one of the event's panels. She says the symposium is a chance to brainstorm about management policies and gather hunters like herself alongside landowners. Hadley breaks down some of the major issues facing the state.
In Montana, hunters want more elk and they want more hunting opportunities, and the landowners want fewer elk in places where they're really causing some serious problems. And of course, the outfitters want guarantees for all their services. So it's a pretty complex situation.
The symposium is taking place as Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks begins to design a new elk management plan. Hadley is part of a panel called Shared Elk and Shared Values. The event starts at 10 a.m. and will be streamed online. It's hosted by the Montana Citizens Elk Management Coalition. Hadley says in some ways the challenges the state faces now are similar to those it faced decades ago, with conflicts between different stakeholders. In the 1990s, Governor Mark Roscoe convened a committee of hunters, landowners, outfitters, and lawmakers. Hadley says one of the ideas to come out of that was the Block Management Program, which provides funds to landowners for impacts from hunters in exchange for opening up access to those lands.
It has existed ever since then, and people in Montana and non-residents who come here have 6 to 7 million acres of private land to hunt, and it all came from that committee of people sitting down and trying to come up with new ideas.
Hadley says Block Management and another program from that time, called Habitat Montana, which is used to purchase conservation easements, have been successful. She hopes this symposium will spark another moment of innovative policymaking.
If we can get Montana people, neighbor to neighbor, talking with each other about our wildlife shared resources, maybe we'll be surprised with some new ideas from people we haven't heard from.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Biden administration will spend $140 million on increasing high-speed internet access for tribal communities. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Biden administration on Thursday announced more than $140 million in awards to bring high-speed, affordable internet to tribal communities in New Mexico through the Tribal Broadband Connectivity Program. Vice President Kamala Harris says she's spoken with tribal leaders across the country about the need for high-speed internet. Harris says the administration is committed to making investments in Indian country.
So our administration's vision is to connect all Native communities with the internet and with the opportunity that comes along with access to affordable internet, the opportunity to live healthier, happier, and more prosperous lives. And we will continue to fight every day to make that vision a reality.
The Pueblo of Isleta was awarded $26 million in funding. Isleta Governor Vernon Abeda says the pandemic heightened the need for the internet as schools, healthcare, and jobs went online. He says internet service is expensive for community members, and although the Pueblo is about a 15-minute drive from Albuquerque, service is unreliable.
So through all of this infrastructure money that we're getting, we will be able to provide these types of services to our community for education, healthcare, and economic development. And the ability to have some programs work from home, have small businesses work from home, using the broadband that we can provide for our communities.
According to the administration, more awards will be announced this month for tribes across the country, including in Alaska, Nebraska, South Dakota, Arizona, and California. Boot camps are bringing people together to learn about tribal broadband. This week, one was held at the University of Oregon in Eugene. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
At the Ford Alumni Center, about 50 people watch presentations on network development, funding, and cable crimping and splicing. Matthew Ballard is with the Shinnecock Indian Nation, based in Long Island, New York. He says historically, Native people have been left behind in technological initiatives, hampering tasks.
Basic things like paying bills, interacting with our governments, being able to start businesses and reach our customers. So it is important for tribes to be here to kind of keep on the bleeding edge of technology and make sure we're not falling further and further behind.
Matthew Rantanen is a Cree tribal member and boot camp organizer.
Our biggest goal is to bring people together because they become a human network, right? We're talking about broadband networking, but we have now a human network of people that they can rely upon for resources, troubleshooting and things, and they know that they're not doing this alone.
The pandemic has especially driven tribes' needs for broadband. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Last week, the Nez Perce tribe, the Spokane tribe, and the Coeur d'Alene tribe and conservation groups made an agreement with the Biden administration to continue a pause in litigation over dams on the Snake and Columbia Rivers. Aaron Bolton has more.
The groups had previously agreed to pause the litigation over restoring salmon and other native fish species to the two rivers. The Biden administration last week announced a commitment to collaborate with Pacific Northwest tribes to restore fish populations while also delivering hydropower to the region. According to a release by Earth Justice, the agreement will pause the lawsuit for another year, but any of the parties involved in the litigation can make a motion to resume legal action. Tribes and conservation groups say they will do so if the Biden administration doesn't take action in a timely manner. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
California Native Americans will share their culture with lawmakers and the public at the state capitol in Sacramento on Monday, the third annual California Indian Cultural Awareness event at Capitol.